And we had a very interesting reentry because there was solid clouds and we couldn't even see, we couldn't see the chutes. We got down below 20,000, couldn't see any chutes until we broke out about 350 feet, 400 feet. We finally broke out of the clouds and we could see, oh, we got all the chutes.
After a successful mission, the Apollo 7 crew landed safely into the Atlantic Ocean, where they were greeted by the buzzing sound of helicopters and the arrival of USS Essex. However, their celebration was short-lived. Soon after, there was Apollo 8, then 9, 10, and 11, all in the span of 10 months. Apollo 7 was quickly forgotten, but their story doesn't end just yet. I'm your host, Matthew Goryczkowski, and you're listening to Apollo 7, The Forgotten Mission.
NASA had picked these guys, and they really wanted them to be this all-American family man. You know, they all had wives, and they had kids, and they had this entire area in Houston where they had built houses so that they could all live together, and there, you know, all the families were together, and they really wanted that all, you know, that so-called all-American life for them to project out to everybody else. But you know, but you can't, you're not like that. Every person is different. Every astronaut is different. They all have their own personalities, and that's eventually going to come out at some time. So it's, I think that caused a lot of tension between NASA and each individual astronaut.
When the original Mercury astronauts were picked in 1959, and Wally Schirra was one of them, they were more than astronauts. They were seen as icons of American culture. They were all American, apple pie, going off to fight the Soviets in a Cold War. They were seen as embodiments of American culture. And in that way, they were supposed to be almost too good to be true. They were supposed to be clean living, not drinking, family guys. Now, if you've ever met any test pilots, you know test pilots are not that way. They like drinking, they like driving fast cars. The stereotype is almost the opposite. So these astronauts had to play kind of a careful game throughout the 1960s of appearing for the media to be very clean cut, while whatever they were actually doing in their life had to be very, very quiet. And they weren't all partiers, but a good number of them were. NASA's opinion on that tended to be, if this gets in the media, you are probably finished as a career. But whatever you're doing in your private time, as long as we don't know about it, and particularly as long as the American public don't know about it, okay, we'll turn a blind eye. There was an example in 1965 of a scientist astronaut called Dwayne Grevelin, who had just been selected for NASA. His wife threatened him with divorce. Didn't even divorce him, threatened him with divorce, and they told him, leave, resign. They told him to resign, essentially, and he never even made the official group photo. He was out within weeks.
In other words, NASA didn't care if the astronauts cheated on their wives. NASA cared if they got caught. Because appearing perfect in the public eye was more important than being honest.
It's curious how astronauts' sociosexual activities tended to run in tight little loops. They seemed to plow the same ground over and over. It could be quite ego-shattering for a guy to discover that his current flame had made it previously with one or more of his cohorts. In fact, he may find out that she was currently dallying with others of the group. However, the psychic trauma was usually minimal since the emotional involvement could be pretty funny. One astrowag coined the term Petersen-law to describe the quasi-incestuous circumstance where two or more astronauts had shared or were sharing the same woman. These adulterous activities ranged from one-night stands with strangers to deep involvements and serious love affairs over prolonged periods of months or even years.
Rather promiscuous, isn't it? During their free time in Cape Kennedy, our heroic astronauts fooled around behind closed doors while their wives stayed home, taking care of their children and keeping up the image of an all-American family for the world. I wonder if there are any astronauts we know that participated in this lifestyle.
I can remember one of the rare times that I participated, and I participated because at the time I got leaned on to go with somebody there. I thought for a second, and I thought, this is going to be what makes me with him. And I can remember doing that. But most of the time, everybody just operated on their own. They did what they wanted to. I wouldn't tell everybody all the things I did, but I'll never forget that first one because, in my opinion, it kind of cut me in on the friendly side of a guy that was important to be on because he was in charge of a lot of things. You figure out your own way that you want to participate, compete, or what have you. There was a few astronauts in those days who were very straight arrows. Remember I told you they were all fighter pilots, and it was not that perfect in being a fighter pilot at that attitude.
So the precedent was, keep your marriage together if you're an astronaut. Now, however bad it is, a number of astronauts kept very shaky marriages together for a number of years for the sake of their careers. Don was coming to the end of his first marriage. He'd met somebody he'd fallen in love with. He ended up marrying her, and they spent the rest of his life together. It was a love match. Unfortunately, this was very unfortunate timing. This was right around the time of his mission. He was told, as was kind of policy, keep this quiet until after the flight. Please don't make any waves.
Well, he was the first...
He was the first one to get divorced.
The first one to get divorced, which...
That totally threw a wrench in their all-American plans.
But he was the first, but he certainly wasn't the last.
Right.
Everybody, he's... started falling like dominoes after that.
We were all kind of shocked that Isley was that wrapped up. And that was before we flew. We had a hard time getting him a day before our launch and 2 days before our launch and having him there for the things that we were doing. He'd be a little late and all that. We kind of knew what was keeping him late. So you've got to be willing to do whatever you have to do on it. And some of the guys, in my opinion, had a very terrible history of doing things like that. I don't know how good their marriages were at the time, but the wives started hanging out together and sharing the stories, and it was tough. But everybody also realized that they couldn't be presenting an image out there that all this was going on. So they looked out for things too.
It's hard to imagine what it's like to come into a culture like NASA's when there are so many public pressures, institutional pressures, the president can have opinions, certainly Congress can have opinions on your own marriage. That's a huge hothouse kind of situation that most of us as private individuals never have to deal with. Susie Isley, her only crime was falling in love with Don Isley, who was a NASA astronaut. And all of a sudden, she's got this incredible amount of pressure on her. When she gets married to him, the other astronaut wives, many of whom were holding together marriages just for the sake of their husband's career, saw her as an enormous threat. What happens if this guy can divorce and remarry and still fly? That means they could go through a divorce and be cast out, and their husbands' careers would continue. She was seen as a threat to the order of NASA families, and so as such was shunned by the other wives. Some of them were very nice to her. Some of them continued to be her friends for the rest of her life, but a couple of them said sort of high schoolish things such as, if she's at that party, I'm going to walk out very, very dramatically. And Susie was a very realistic person. She's like, I don't have time to deal with this nonsense. What is this? I've just fallen in love with this guy. What is this nonsense? Very difficult for her. Don could see that too, and it was pretty clear that they needed to get out of Houston if they were going to have any kind of happy life. So Don was able to get a transfer to NASA Langley. This was away from all the Houston office politics and petty personal politics. They loved him up there. They made lifelong friends. They had a great time, and he finished out his NASA career as part of a very happy marriage. And it was clear it was a love match for the next couple of decades. They were together right up until Don's passed away. This was obviously the marriage for him.
You know yourself what you accomplished. It's nice when others recognize your achievements, but the way that you feel about yourself is more important. It doesn't pay to worry too much about what others think. Walt, Wally, and I are the only ones who will ever know what the flight of Apollo 7 was really like. I'll always remember.
Apollo 7 was a mission of firsts. Even with all the hysteria, controversy, and drama, without it, we wouldn't have made it to the moon as soon as we did, or at all. Wally, Walt, and Don were the first to prove NASA's ability to accomplish the impossible. Yet they were never allowed to fly again. Why is that? Because the world, for the first time, saw that astronauts were only human, and NASA didn't like that. The 1960s were a different time. Back then, NASA needed the illusion of perfection known as the All-American persona. And back then, that was considered the white military family man. NASA wasn't looking for the most skilled. They were looking for people that would appear that way to the United States and to Congress, because Congress gives NASA funding. However, times change. After Don Isay's divorce, many other astronauts began divorcing their wives too. The All-American illusion was shattered, paving the way to discovering what All-American truly means. And what that means is a celebration of diversity. Today, NASA hires an increasing amount of women, people of color, and a vast array of highly qualified individuals. Because not only does that look the best for NASA, that's what the best is. A celebration and appreciation of our differences that contribute to the beauty and success of humanity. A huge thank you to our interviewees, Walter Cunningham, Francis French, Christy Isley, Andrew Isley, and our Don Isley narrator, David Kaufman. This podcast is produced and edited by me, Matthew Gorichkovsky. Original music composed by Jamie Bungan. Our sound recordists are Christian Black, Philip Long, Nancy Nguyen, and Matthew Crouchley. Our co-sound mixer is Daniel Mammon. Special thank you to University of California Irvine's digital filmmaking faculty, Ulysses Jenkins, Brian Jackson, and Bruce Yanemoto, and to my friends and family, Nick Levy, David Toledo, Enrique Aceves, Gabriel Campos, Cameron Baluch, Sam Vedernikov, Yefim Vedernikov, Aaron Gorichkovsky, and Nadia Malamud. This production was made in collaboration with the University of California Irvine Digital Filmmaking Program. Excerpts were taken from the autobiography Apollo Pilot, The Memoir of Astronaut Don Isley, edited by Francis French, and can be bought on Amazon for those that are interested. The 1998 interview done with Wally Schirra was conducted by NASA's Oral History Program at the NASA Johnson Space Center. In addition, we will be uploading all full-length interviews to our YouTube channel, Apollo 7, The Forgotten Mission, made possible by our cinematographer Corey Nguyen and camera operators Philip Long and Christian Black. Check it out if you're interested in listening to the complete interviews. As a reminder, all episodes are currently published and available for you to enjoy. Thank you for listening, and that's a wrap for this series.